Peter Turchi is the author of a novel and a collection of short stories, and he's co-edited volumes of short fiction with Charles Baxter and Andrea Barrett. Turchi directs the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina. His students can take the title of his most recent book as an object lesson in how to pique a reader's interest. The book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer. That title, and a really clever cover with a drawing of a human head superimposed on a map grid, was enough to get Steve Paulson talking to Peter Turchi.
What is the connection between writing and maps?
Well, a lot of people talk about, and readers often talk about, being lost in the world of a story or a novel. And they don't talk about it the way you talk about being lost in the mall or lost downtown, you know, trying to find a parking space. There's something delightful about being lost in a story or a novel. And there's a sense that you're in some world. You've been taken someplace you want to stay. And you're happy to have been transported in that way. And so I started to think about whether that means that we're following a map, or a writer's job is to make a map that leads a reader somewhere, or how it is that when you read, you have that experience of being taken to some new place.
So you're saying, just as a map is all about exploration, it's about especially those people who actually created the maps, it's about going into the unknown and charting undiscovered territory. You're saying that's really what writing is all about, and I suppose in some ways reading as well.
Well, the writer's job is in part a matter of exploration. You have an idea, or you think of a situation and characters, and you explore and try to figure it out. And then your job is to create a path or a chart for the reader. And of course, part of the fun of writing is that you're not necessarily trying to tell a reader exactly where to go and what to do. You're trying to create an experience for the reader.
Hmm. Well, there's an interesting question. Is the best map the most accurate map, the one with the most detail?
Oh, it certainly is not, because when you think about the map you want, the map I took, say, to get to the radio station today, I want street information. I want to know what turns to make. I don't particularly care, say, where the sewer lines run. I don't care where the bird nesting sites are. I don't care what the zoning is. There's all kinds of information I don't want on that map, because if it's there, I won't be able to find what I need to find. And so, in fact, it's what we leave off the map that defines the map. Because if we wanted to put everything on the map, we've got that in the world. You know, we've got everything there. What we're doing when we make a map is subtract information and highlight information. And of course, that's true of writing.
Yeah. Well, I think about those subway maps we see, the ones in a big city where there are all those different train lines that are outlined in bright colors. And I'm sure those are geographically not terribly accurate, in these straight lines. But they sure are effective because, you know when to get off on the right stop.
There's a wonderful lesson there for every writer, right? We think we want accuracy and we think we want detail, but there is a map, famously the tube map in London, that was so filled with information and so dense and difficult to read that people didn't know what train to get on or how to get where they were going. And so the Wayfinder, the first version of that map, reduced those lines so that they were color-coded, so that the angles, they were limited in the angles they used, 45 and 30 and 60 and 90 and 100 degree angles. And the only information on the map was the name of the stops. And they weren't necessarily even set apart on the map, at correct distances, so that one might be twice as far as another. They were set so you could read them. When you're trying to get on a subway, all you need to know is which line to get on and which stop to get off of. You don't want any other information. A lot of times when we sit down to write something, especially if we're writing, say, realistic fiction, we think we need to tell the reader everything from the beginning of a character's day to the end of the day, what job he has and what irritates him about it, everything. But in fact, every story is selective and every story has to guide us in certain ways, and there will always be crucial omissions.
Now, one point you make in your book is that all fiction lies. I mean, by its very nature, it is a lie because it's concocting imaginary worlds. And you say that that's true with maps as well. All maps lie, which is not nearly as obvious to me.
Oh, no. Well, every map says that it's telling the truth, of course. I mean, that's how maps operate. But there are distortions. I mean, the crucial thing is not that they actually have inaccuracies. The question is, what is accuracy in a map? The most obvious example is, what in geography class they'll call the orange peel problem. The problem with trying to map any spot on the Earth is that you're making something on a flat sheet of paper. And of course, the Earth is not flat. And to convey the curved surface or the irregular surface of the Earth on a piece of paper, there has to be some distortion. Famously, in the Mercator projection that most people know from maps they saw all through childhood and even now, it looks as if Greenland is the size of South America.
Right. Greenland is huge.
And I think that's important for writers to recognize, because we think, okay, if we read some very experimental work, maybe, that seems distorted, that seems unlifelike. But realism is a distortion too. And maybe it's easiest to imagine this when you think about realism in the visual arts. When you think about that old exercise in perspective we all did in art class, where you try to draw a building, you know, so that it recedes into the distance, and you draw, say, the lines on the rooftop so that they meet in the back corner of it. Well, you know, in life, the two sides of that building don't meet. They don't touch that way, right? The road doesn't disappear into a point in real life. But what we're trying to do is to recreate what we see. And so to try to recreate our perception, we're distorting what really exists. You know, eventually that Mercator projection was so dominant in map making that people just started to see the world that way. And in fact, well, another example of that is we're used to seeing the United States in the middle of maps. So when you go to Australia, say, and they hand you their, well, they actually even call it the upside down map, but a map oriented toward the south, because there's no reason for a map to be oriented north necessarily. If it's oriented to the south and Australia is in the center of the map, you say, well, you know, what's with this? Is this some kind of joke? And you say, well, you know, what kind of map is this? How could you use that?
So everyone wants to put themselves at the center, or their culture, their world in the middle of things.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, that's a wonderful thing to remember about characters, too. When you're writing about, you know, any piece of fiction from a character's perspective, we all, you know, see from our point, and it distorts our sense of the world. A famous example of that is that old cover of The New Yorker that showed, you know, the view of the world from 9th Avenue, I think it is, right? Saul Steinberg's image, where you see various parts of New York up close, and then you see, you know, the middle of the country all but disappears. You see California, just a little sliver off on the horizon, and then we know Europe is out there somewhere. The New Yorker's view of the world. But we all have some of that sense of the world, too. You know, what's nearest looms large.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have pored over lots of maps from the centuries. Do you have one or two favorites you've come across?
You know, some of the maps we love are just beautiful. And one of the maps I have in the book is of the world's longest rivers and the world's tallest mountains. And it's one of the strangest maps in there because it doesn't attempt to locate those mountains and rivers, you know, in particular countries or even on particular continents. They're just shown next to each other. It's a very useful map for comparing those things. If you've ever wondered how long the Nile is compared to the Mississippi, say, this is the way to see it. If you've ever wondered, you know, how tall Kilimanjaro is compared to Mount Everest, it would be a terrible hiking map. And it, you know, reminds me that sometimes the most inventive fiction, the most experimental work we read, which seems, you know, unrealistic, sometimes its value is that it allows us to see the world in a way we had never thought of seeing it, but which turns out to be useful.
Huh. And then there are some writers who actually include maps in their stories. I mean, basically to help the readers, because there can be very convoluted plots, and especially if it's a fantasy story, you're wondering where things are. It really helps to be able to look at this and see where things are in relation to each other.
Yeah, one of my favorite examples, and there's a reproduction of it in the book, is Robert Louis Stevenson's Map of Treasure Island. That was the first real book I read. The first adult book I read was Treasure Island, and I remember being captivated by the map, of course. The notion of treasure maps is pretty fascinating, and people's obsession with those. But the wonderful thing about that story is that Stevenson was just out drawing. He drew the map, and he was so enchanted by the map that he started to tell a story about it. He ended up writing what we know as Treasure Island. He sent it off to his publisher. But when he did, the map got lost. And the, you know, when he told the publisher, he said, you know, there was supposed to be a map with this when they printed it. When they had the galleys, they said they hadn't gotten it, and he had to recreate it. And he said it was the most painful thing to have to go back through the manuscript and to figure out where everything belonged and, you know, where it had to be for certain things to make sense. So he said the map that appears in the book, the map we all know as the map of Treasure Island, is not Treasure Island to him.
That's a great story. and obviously that really mattered to him. I mean, some people would think, oh, you know, who cares if there's a map that accompanies the story? But for him, it really was important.
Oh, well, and it speaks in a metaphorical way, too, of course, because we, you know, a writer always has a notion of his story or his novel or, you know, or poem. We always have a sense of the work, and then readers get the work, and they bring their own, you know, background and understanding to it. And so they say, oh, I love that book. I especially love the way you emphasized whatever. And they'll say, huh, you know, I hadn't really thought about it that way. You know, that's not what I had in mind. But after a point, you know, the book or the story exists out in the world, and it is completed by the reader's experience. So even if Stevenson had the original map of Treasure Island in the book, at some point, you know, the book that he sent out into the world was going to be interpreted by other people differently, seen by other people differently.
Peter Turchi is the author of Maps of the Imagination, the writer as cartographer. He spoke with Steve Paulson.